John W. Campbell, at least not as an editor, but as the longest running person out of magazine. That's my new claim to fame. But anyways, other than that, I'm editor of Asimov, so.
Hi, I'm Neil Clark. I'm the publisher and editor of Clark's World Magazine and Forever Magazine, and I'm also the editor of the Best Science Fiction of the Year for Nightshade Books.
And I'm Jonathan Strahm. I'm the reviews editor for Locus. I am the editor of the Best Science Fiction and Fantasy of the Year for Solaris. I edit original anthologies, and I am the host and producer for the Coot Street podcast.
And my name is Dave Truesdale. I'm the editor of Tangent Online, which reviews nothing but short fiction and has for about 23 years. And I guess that's why they volunteered me to be on this panel with all these other guys. So. Oh, no, I'm not. Wait. Dave Truesdale, editor of Tangent Online for the past 23 years. You review nothing but short fiction. And that's not Gordon. Okay. Well, this says something here on this panel. It's supposed to be about the golden age of science fiction. I hate to say it, but I really don't think we are in one right now. I think we have some problems we need to discuss. And if you're easily offended, you might not want to stay for all of this, or you may want to, because I'm going to title my opening remarks, which will leave plenty of time for everybody else, as, and I wouldn't do this if I didn't think it was important, I'm titling this Science Fiction is Not for Snowflakes. Science fiction is not for snowflakes. Snowflakes being those people who seem to have graduated from the University of the Perpetually Offended with honors in microaggression. And they come out of these universities with what I call microaggressive disorder, or MAD. And they walk around, you see them on social media and everywhere else, they seem like they have snowflake Tourette's. Every other word is fine, and then all of a sudden they'll go, oh, sexism, homophobia, racism. And before long, everybody is offended, or you can't do anything without being offended. And that's killing science fiction. It's killing short science fiction. And so, to ease the pain of this, when people get the vapors, when they get easily offended, what they need to do is, if they don't have pearls to clutch, they need to clutch some pearls. So you put these pearls on, yes, and you clutch them. And you're okay after that. You don't feel as offended. Hell, I wake up in the morning, I look in the mirror, I'm offended at myself. I put these pearls on, and I'm not nearly as offended. I think, well, it's okay, it works. So if anybody else or anybody near you, you see them getting the vapors or getting offended.
Do you want to be offensive to make your point?
Let me finish. You guys will have your chance. Let me finish. This won't take that long. David Hartwell, the day before he passed away, was talking with Andy Duncan on the phone. Andy has posted part of this conversation on the air or online. And for everybody who thinks that every person is victimized or discriminated against in science fiction, which seems to be the norm these days. You think everybody's a victim. You can't say or do anything without somebody being offended. And I'm going to tie this in now to protecting short fiction, but I'd like to offer a different view. And this is from David Hartwell. This is what Andy says in a phone conversation. David says, like many other small towns, post-war science fiction could be insular, clannish, and deplorably tolerant of wrongdoing. But mostly and more importantly, it could be remarkably tolerant, even welcoming, of eccentricity, of divergence from the norm. Even in the mid-20th century, David continued, science fiction was a haven for gay and bi and trans people, for people in open marriages and triads, or even more complex domestic scenarios, for people with physical and mental disabilities, for shameless exhibitionists and unapologetic recluses, for anarchists and socialists and birchers and libertarians and weathermen and CIA operatives, for cosplayers, gamers and creative anachronists and people who crafted wholly spurious biographies for themselves that were accepted and therefore became sort of true. Scientologists and Orthodox Jews and pre-Vatican II Catholics and Mormons and New Agers and heretics and atheists and freethinkers for PhDs and autodidacts for writers of COBOL and speakers of Esperanto for Fordians and Psychops for astronomers and astrologers for psychics and physicists for basically anyone who is smart and passionate and willing to pitch in somewhere, though talent certainly helped and curiosity and a zeal for argument and a sense of humor. And what I take for this is science fiction has always been open to all types in fandom, in the writing, in the literature, and it kind of puts a lie to the myth that all these kinds of people have been discriminated against. And I don't understand where we've come to this point where people, a certain segment who seem to make it their day, their social agenda is more important than the literary aspect. They bully, they terrify, they intimidate, they've cost people their jobs just because these people do not agree with exactly what they believe in. And it's translating itself into the short fiction these days, and it can be demonstrated, and it's not good for the field.
David, you've done the same thing for years. You've bullied people when you didn't like a story. You've gone after magazines.
I didn't, sir. No, criticism is different.
No, criticism is not different. When you had a personal vendetta author, I can think of a story that I published 11 years ago that you were so angry about.
About what?
It's the British author. He's a big novel. He writes mostly novels.
I do criticism. That's what I do, though.
And no, this was not criticism. This was going on my end, really just, and not relenting about a story about squirrels, intelligent squirrels. But the point is, everyone admits, everyone agrees that science fiction has been open to many types of fiction, and that's the way it should be. For a long time. It's also had many blinders on, many things that were, you know, were offensive and upsetting. And there are different eras where certain things are more upsetting and sometimes than others just because of the eras they come out of. And writers can write things and get criticized for them. That's your prerogative as a critic. It's fine. But I don't worry about, I don't clutch pearls, and I don't think anyone needs to worry about that.
Not you.
And I don't think that there's anything's happening to the field. It's great that you're upset about it. But you know what? There's lots of great conservative fiction being written.
This is
there's lots of awful conservative fiction being written.
Where is great conservative short fiction being written? Oh, I thought she was done.
What do you think? You're not seeing any conservative fiction? I'm not going to go into that. I'm just going to say I'm very proud of the work at Asimov's, and it's not because I do not worry. I am never going to satisfy all the critics, no matter what I do. I have stories that have been blasted because the author was worried about government-run healthcare. And I've had stories that were blasted because, as in Dave's case, a man in a suit was attacked by a talking squirrel. I've had stories where, you know, people have been mad at me because there were, you know, too many gay and lesbian relationships in the issue of the magazine. I've had situations where people have been mad at me because words were used that the author and I hadn't even realized were offensive. But in hindsight, because we hadn't thought outside of our own country, different culture, that when you reprint the story, he's not going to use the word because it hadn't occurred. He had not intended to create, to offend. He wasn't purposely setting out to be offensive. He wasn't designing a character that was meant to be. So I've had, and I'm never going to satisfy. Part of the joy of and terrifying act of being an editor is that every time you let your issue you're stepping off a cliff. And you're always going to be attacked by everyone, and that's great. Fiction is about taking chances. It's about taking risks. And I don't worry. I think, you know, I try not to have the stories be didactic. It's kind of boring when they are. I tell, and often many stories come in that are really worried about a very current issue, the current election or something. And that, of course, will become very boring 6 months from now. No one's going to care about a particular issue. So I will say to an author, you can relook at this story, try to make this story a timely story for all times. But the big thing about fiction has always been it's at the forefront. It takes risks. It's going to be criticized. Authors have to get used to that. Editors have to get used to that. You can't be... you can be thin-skinned, but you better just tell your family at home that you are, because, you know, it's just the way it is. And I don't think there's anything to apologize for. I don't think it's hurting the field in any way.
Neil?
I think that opening a conversation on tolerance by calling people special snowflakes is a good example of a lack of tolerance. What?
You turned your back first.
Yes, because what I am
here.
I did not leave the room. I refused. I was giving a non-verbal demonstration of what I thought. Hey, calm down.
He has the right.
Listen, I have the right to do that. You have the right to be upset with me for doing it, and that's fine. But this is a panel about the state of short fiction. Why is it being hijacked for this agenda? We're starting off with a discussion about how certain people in this community have an agenda, and here we are in a panel about the state of short fiction, which so many people came to show up for. They did not come to see that happen.
I would appreciate it if, although there's a lot of interest. Although this is going to be a hot topic and a lot of interest in the crowd here, please keep your comments to yourselves until the question and answer period, because we don't want this to devolve into something else. And anything you want to start out? Gordon? Jonathan?
Look, I'm happy to say that I primarily tend to agree with Neil. I don't think this is a topic that I intended to see raised in this environment for this subject. You're entitled to have your opinion. I'm not particularly convinced by one anecdotal statement by one particular person that a particular set of events happened to be the case at a particular point in time. I think there's a lot of evidence that on a publishing level, which is what we're about, that our field is becoming more open and more inclusive. And I think that's by and large to our great benefit, even though there are some things that come along with it. I feel like it does seem as though there's been a very significant attempt to take us away from the topic at hand, and I think that's a problem.
I really wasn't finished. I was going to tie this indirectly to short fiction. I didn't have a chance to finish, so I'm going to let the panel speak.
I'm not sure I have anything to add at this point, because it doesn't seem like we're really on the subject yet. So I'd like to hear it tied in before I get into it.
Okay. You don't, Sheila, you don't see any political correctness at all going on here? People have been threatened.
There are
There
are certainly people. People have different points of views. And what one person's political correctness is another person's just ordinary expectations, and vice versa. I mean, it's not, that happens all the time. And has that not always been the case? I was at the Negro League Baseball Museum yesterday, and I found myself in tears because, you know, Jackie Robinson was not the first African-American to play baseball in the major leagues. But the last one to play baseball in the major leagues was 1897. I mean, I was like, you know, that was fine. You know why? Because people said you know, 40,000 people said, you know, they wouldn't come to the games, or they'd kill the baseball players, or they, you know, to kill the commissioner or whatever. It was the normal expectations. The players couldn't stay at hotels, they couldn't eat at restaurants, they couldn't, you know, and that was fine because that was fine. I'm not saying that was fine, because that was the order of the day. I mean, it was just, I was in tears at that museum, thinking about that as the order of the day, thinking that there had been a change. There had been quite a few African-American baseball players, and then there were none. And there was a rule made in the 1880s, but no one was sewing. That's why the last one stopped playing. The last ball. And I think this is, so we have a country that goes in its waves, and we have our expectations of what's okay and what isn't, and this is one error like any other error, but I don't worry about it. I have lots of great stories to choose from. I have authors with very many points of views to choose from, and I like a broad range of stories. I don't worry about an author's political opinion when I'm buying a story. As I tell everyone, I read the cover letter after I read the story, so I don't even know anything about the authors, and I don't have any agenda.
I do have an agenda, but I'm not particularly aware of it. And it's our era, and I'm really pleased that in our era we actually are more considerate of people's feelings. Yes, we can use more. In ASMOS of 2016, we can use more curse words than we could have in 1976, or 1977 actually, because that's when we started. But there are other words we don't use, and those words are insulting, and they don't need to be used. They don't make a point. And when they are, you know, the point can be made. Isaac Asimov was a strong believer that you can make any point by using language well. You don't have to use it to shock. And I just avoid it. I'm pleased that I'm living in an era where we're more aware, but that doesn't mean I don't buy stories where the characters have very many diverse viewpoints. And I'm not worried about it. You know, if somebody really wants to publish a very different type of fiction from me, there are other publishers, there are other places to be published, and, you know, and other editors with different viewpoints. So it's not my job to worry about everybody's viewpoint. I just have my own and the stories I like. And they're going to be influenced by my viewpoint, that I'm the ideal Asimov reader because I'm the editor of Asimov. So the times have changed, and they always change, thank goodness.
I'm not disagreeing with you, but I think reading a ton of magazines, all the different magazines for so long, you can spot a trend where a lot of the stories, despite the subject matter or the theme or whatever, they're blander, they're more bland. There are certain things you have the same SF, you know, you have the same SF tropes and adventures and this and that, but when it comes to what I call the internals of a story, the thoughts of a character or the narration or the dialogue, if it comes to a whole range of different topics, by and large, you kind of only see one viewpoint. And that's fine. People can write and read whatever they want to. That's the thing. We're open about this. One of my beefs here, and I didn't mean to, I'm wanting to continue this a little bit, but is that there is a certain group of people who just can't stand any different opinion, and they have bullied, intimidated people. People have lost their jobs over this. You know, and it's just they can't stand any little difference. It's the way you say a name, or you can't use he or is a she or this or that in a story, or they're going to crucify you. And it's not fair. You have to have equal numbers of male and female on the cover, for instance, is one thing.
No, I don't.
Not
I
you,
no.
But every and once in a while, somebody doesn't have the equal number of male or female on a cover, and it's not his fault.
I can jump in here and say that. I certainly, FNSF certainly have not had 50-50 male, female in every cover, and I have gotten complaints about it. I don't usually respond to the complaints, but they certainly do come in with some frequency. I really don't worry about them much, but there are some people who do take issue with it.
There are going to be people that take issue. I do not know that anyone, sometimes you're criticized for everything. And especially, there are times when your magazine is criticized for everything. So when I wasn't taking digital submissions, I was criticized for everything I did, no matter what I did. And when I started taking digital submissions, I wasn't criticized for many things anymore. So it was just a sea change overnight. But, I think there are issues such as 30% of our, no more than 30% of our submissions come from women. So at any given time, it's unlikely. I would say actually most, it's even less than 30, it's between 25 and 30%. And I publish between 30 and 35%. So there's a slight, a little bit more I publish, but it's partly because I think I get a lot of, I've known a lot of women for years, a lot of really well-known established women, and a lot of new women coming in, and so I think I actually get a lot of, I see a lot of their stuff early, so I think that works to my advantage. That's part of my explanation, but for that very reason, I'm not going to have 50-50. I would love that world. I'm hoping for that world. I work all the time for that world. I have two daughters. I sent one to the Bronx High School of Science. You know, I really would like to see a world where there are a lot more women reading and writing science fiction, and I think it's improving all the time. It's very exciting. And it's and I hope I myself am a role model to young women and all women, because, you know, I came up, I am the only woman working on a science fiction magazine. I'm the only woman who has, you know, a full-time salary position at a science fiction magazine. And I've never felt, have only rarely been discriminated against in the course of my career, but, you know, I've worked really hard and I'm really proud of it, but I also hope that young women out there say, oh, look, she did that, I can do that. I mean, it's just a good thing, that's, you know, the world, but I'm not gonna have 50-50 on the cover, because I'm not gonna have, I just don't. On occasion, I have had issues that were, and I've been really excited about that, you know, they were 50-50. But it's just, for me, the hard part is not having enough submissions. I know Neil, though, on the other hand, has a terrific record. You get a lot more.
We've gotten hate mail for publishing not enough men. Both sides do it. Mm-hmm. You know, there's always somebody that's a little unhappy with some aspect of what they feel is a perceived injustice, or it might even be a real one. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we have, that's the field we work in.
I remember one incident a couple of years ago, just to finish off this little section here and move on, where a certain editor put together an original anthology, and he had contracted male, female, pretty much equal all the way around. Came time for deadline, and through no fault of anybody's, a lot of the females couldn't do it, and he was desperate at deadline. And so he called and did whatever he had to do to get the stories to fill for publisher's deadline. And when the book came out, and there was, like, I don't know exact figure, but way over more men than women, the poor guy, wasn't his fault at all. He was excoriated and raked across the coals for something he had no control over, because he didn't have enough women, either in the book or on the cover. And it was just a sad, sad thing. Good editor was trying to do a good job, but it wasn't enough for these people. Raked him over the coals. So it does happen.
These people who are, I understand. Oh, it was worked up, but they're.
You didn't know anything about that?
No,
you
I know about that.
So they did
but
then.
It's, you know, you're an editor. You let your book go and you may get criticized for it. You got to live with that.
Yeah, but for something like that, though?
You know what?
There's always something that someone's going to complain about. The truth is, there are people on the left who behave badly, there are people on the right who behave badly. By and large, that's my observation over the last 20 years in my career, that the middle has become broader and the middle has become more tolerant. It's just that the small edges have become angrier and less tolerant. I've been criticized for exactly what you're talking about, and actually, although it was unpleasant, I found it a learning experience, mm-hmm. and I don't regret it at all. So, you know, I've walked through the valley of fire, I've had stuff thrown at me, I've had panels held about me at WISCON about how I did a terrible job.
There you go, WISCON.
And you know what? No, not there you go, WISCON. There are a good bunch of people who are holding a convention. I don't think you can just, you should, you know, if you're going to reduce any group of people to a simple dismissive there you go, then you're not really engaging with them a whole hell of a lot. And you know what happened? They held their panel, they expressed their views, and I was fine. And I had a career that went on, and my book did perfectly well and was nominated for awards, and life was good, and I learned a little bit different, you know, a little bit more. Because the thing that's happening over the last 20 years of the observation of my career and my time in science fiction is that we listen to more people, not less. We hear from people from a broader variety of places, not less.
That's a good thing.
If you want to bring it back to the actual state of short fiction, if there's a flaw in the in short fiction right now, it's not that. It's not even being angry about that. The problem is, I think, that there's such a broad, diverse range of publications that there's no coherent way to observe what's happening in the field. There is such a volume of material produced, you can't read it all, the gems get diluted and washed away. I just walked out of a panel that Gordon was the moderator on about the state of short fiction in the 1980s, where you had effectively three central markets, people were competing against other, and you could see easily how things were going. That's not the case today. But that is something that the field will evolve through. And I think, you know, if you are going to make, and you obviously feel these are legitimate criticisms, and that's fine, you also need to look at what's going right in this field. And there's a lot more, I think, going right in the field than is going wrong. And I say that, as I say, from someone who was kicked to the curb very unpleasantly over these issues. And you know what? You just get up and get on with it, and life goes on, and things get better, and you learn more. I've had the problem your friend, the example you're citing, exactly that problem.
That's who I was referring to. I didn't want to
mention
you're
his name. No, I don't mind.
I didn't want to mention his name. Okay. That was him.
So I edited a book called Eclipse 3, and it actually was 50-50 women content. But they got the balance of names on the cover wrong. It was roundly criticized.
Yep.
You know what I realized? My book was richer the broader range of people who are in it. I liked my book better.
Right.
I liked the voices I was reading better. And yes, I adjusted the way that I solicited material and the people I went looking for. But you know what? That's what responsible editing is.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
You know, it's not just, I mean, amongst other things, believe it or not, you've got to get what you're doing to the public so that they can read it. And if they, you know, and so you've got to some degree, make your piece of communication work that way. And that means making it that people can see themselves in it. You know, I think we close this off. And I mean that, you know, we cannot be less sensitive to people who are on the right than we are on the left. But I think we also have to realize that inclusiveness is what will make us win.
That's fine. I have no problem with that. The major problem I have, and I still go back to it, is that there's too much intimidation from the left. Writers are getting intimidated whether they know it or not.
I think what you get is a punching back down with a writer trying to shut the left up. Mm-hmm. But I don't think that's the topic of this panel.
Where do you see that? Well,
I don't think this is the topic of the panel.
Stanley Smith told me years ago as advice, an observation he had seen, and I absolutely knew he was right when he said it, that people only notice the politics and the stories that they disagree with.
That's true.
And so he can publish, he had a regular author who was, I don't remember if he's a communist or a socialist, but he's been in for years and years, and he published them all the time, but then he published some story that had a much more conservative viewpoint, and he'd get a letter from someone saying, people would say, well, he never publishes anything by somebody liberal, you know. And then he'd, of course, he said, I had recently been criticized for the opposite. So he was just saying to me, and I was pointing out to him these stories I had recently published with very conservative viewpoints, and he said, yes, but your reader only noticed the politics that they disagreed with. And he said, that's what happens to me, is, sometimes in the opposite direction. I don't see that as bullying. You know what? People can cancel their subscription. I always think saying I'm going to cancel my subscription because one thing that happened that I disagreed with is really, I think, a mistake. In my own personal opinion, we read to broaden our viewpoints in general. And I think it's sad in this world, in our society today, to see this hardening of right versus left, when in fact in fiction I think there's always many ideas cross over backward and forward. You have anarchists and libertarians, which are not always all that far, and they're in the spectrum from each other, though they might all hate each other and want to kill each other, but they're really, sometimes if you look at their ideas back and forth, there's cross-pollination. And I don't think it has to be, it's, you know, go off in high dungeon, but people do, and if they want to, and it's okay. And there are times someone's going to be upset with me. I got this letter from this man, a couple of letters, about this one story, and they were about the use of this word that was upsetting to the readers who happened to not be American. So it was also a point of information. And, I wasn't going to, like, go and say, resign and never, publish another issue of the magazine because I might make this mistake again. I'm going to make mistakes over and over, or I'm going to publish stories over and over again. But I often think that's a mark. Well, I'm not deliberately trying to offend people, but at the same time, I think stimulating, not controversy, but thinking and talking and reacting is what writing and reading is all about. We don't read so that we're going to agree with everything we read. We read because we want to think of something new that we never thought of before, or looked at from another angle. And we don't have to agree with it when we read it. It was like, they're going to be horrified by that. Oh, that's from an angle. I don't like that angle. But it gives, it's a fresh perspective. It's a different way of looking at something. And I can feel bad, as I did in that particular instance, but I can't. I'm really glad to have the information, but I'm going to keep publishing, and I'm going to keep
stepping on toes, and then I'm also going to keep getting people who say, I really love that story, and I'm so glad you published it. So, you know, and fortunately, I hear that pretty frequently, too, so it makes it rewarding. And, you know, there's, I've followed Stan's, I've paid attention to what he said. I think he has, it was quite true, and I've seen it happen over and over again in my own magazine. So.
Gordon, have you seen many changes in FNSF over the years in this? Kind of stories you were getting,
right.
Things?
I would have to say I've seen some change, yes. You know, someone mentioned I just moderated a panel on short fiction in the 80s. I was saying there that I just recently looked up, saw a movie from 1962, and I was amazed that one of the actresses in it didn't get an Oscar nomination. I looked at who did, and the movies coming out in the 60s that were on the Oscar list. Some forgettable, but a lot of astonishing films. The Hustler, I'm blanking on the list now, but it was, I looked at it as, wow, man, that was really the height of the studio system. And it had its weaknesses and flaws. I mean, I think that Elizabeth Taylor, Cleopatra came out around then. So it wasn't all great, but it really produced some great stuff. And we were talking about the 80s, and I was thinking how there weren't that many markets. You know, if you wrote a story and Ed Furman, Stan Schmidt, Gardner, or Shauna, Terry Card, they didn't like it, you really had to, had to take a step down and accept publication in the lower market or not get accomplished at all. I think in the market today, it's so different from, say, 1997 when I started. And that, as Jonathan was saying, there's so many markets, and if you try every market, you still won't find anyone willing to publish your stuff. You just publish it yourself. It's such a different environment that I have seen I have seen some differences, I think, in the short fiction. And I have to add, I'm not reading submissions at the moment. You know, I haven't for 2 years now. So I'm not seeing everything that comes in. But I am seeing, to my eyes anyway, something that does tie in with what Dave was saying, that I see a fear of taking risks. And I think some of this is just generational. I think a lot of people, millennials of the couples, I don't like that term that much, but people who grew up in the internet age with social media do tend, in my experience, do tend to be a little more afraid of ticking someone off than some people who grew up in, you know, in the 50s and 60s, just as an example. I would have to say that's the main thing that I've seen. I would also say there's less interest in distinguishing between science fiction and fantasy.
Well, that's been going on.
But I don't think it's ever been this bad.
No.
I feel like things have gotten so murky. To me, the turning point was about 9 years ago when Ted Chiang's Merchant and the Alchemist's Gate came out.
Mm-hmm. And from here?
Yes. And from Subterranean. And it appeared in a science fiction anthology. And in the American fantasy anthology. And nobody ever said, wait, is this story science fiction or fantasy? There was just a complete lack of interest. And I talked with Ted about it, and it's science fiction in his eyes. That doesn't mean it's science fiction in the reader's eyes necessarily, but it does, I do understand what the SFNL underpinnings of it. I found after that, but it was no longer really of interest to most readers that I could tell. You know, is it SF or is it fantasy? And I think everyone on the panel here is old enough to remember when it was a huge issue. You know, what is science fiction? Is that SF or isn't it? I think things have changed a lot in that regard. It's no longer an issue.
Well, I'm still publishing a science fiction magazine with some fantasy.
Yep.
And so I see distinctions. And I see stories that are crossover, the ones that are, you know, like any kind of evolution, you've got the ones that are fantasy and the ones that are science fiction and the ones that's all up to your interpretation of the story.
Yeah.
I remember talking to Ted, and he said he had to send the story to you because it was not an Asimov story. And then when I read it, I was like, the story could just as easily have been an Asimov as because it was science fiction. But I want to disagree with the risk-taking, because I think writers are taking risks. They're worried about offending different people. They're not worried about offending different groups of people. I don't think there's that writers are not taking risks. I have...
Just to correct, I didn't say that they're not taking risks. I said I'm seeing an aversion to taking risks. That I think writers themselves what I'm seeing and feeling is a reluctance to take those risks.
You know, it's an interesting. You know, what is a risk? Whenever I put an issue out, I'm worried about a lot of things. You guys don't even think about all the things I worry about. So I have a story coming out. I think it's in the latest issue. And it's called
Mutants.
That's not the one. It's called President John F. Kennedy, Astronauts. Now, I published a story about 10 years ago by Christine Catherine Rush that was, Apollo 13? It was a story, it was about what if the astronauts had not survived who were in the accident. It's Apollo 13. Okay. And I was severely criticized for writing about the fact that she wrote about the possible death of people who were still alive. How upsetting this would be for their families if they read the story. And even though she had handled it very respectfully, I thought, I had several critics and readers writing. One reader saying how his son was so upset, and then he had to tell him that astronauts were still alive, but he felt so awful they had this conversation. And I was like, but would you have had a conversation at all about Apollo 13 if you hadn't read the story, you know? Because he said they'd had this conversation at the dinner table, and actually I got an editorial out of it. But I was a little bit worried publishing a story about where John F. Kennedy may or not have died in 1963 because of an alien doctor, because I thought a lot of people, you know, a lot of deep admiration for John F. Kennedy, and you know, I can easily see people, readers, saying, it's my favorite president, and I don't think you should be playing with his history, etc. So I think that there are so many ways that authors can take risks, continue to take risks, and but the risks, different points of views, you know, different.
I guess it's partly that I cut my teeth on dangerous visions and a lot of new wave stuff. And so I've read the story you mentioned, and to me, it didn't have the daring that, the risk in it wasn't as daring as the stuff that speaks to me.
Those stories are, I mean, you read those stories today, they're normal. Or you take a story like, if all men were brothers, would you let one marry your sister? Yeah. Which is, yeah. You know, was revolutionary at the time, wouldn't go over very well right now. I think we have a more difficult, it's a different interpretation of it now. It's times change, eras change.
How well do you think would go over Phil Dick's story from, I think it was 1974, The Pre-Persons, where it was where abortion was not an option? You had to carry the child.
Would a
pro-life story go over pretty well there, you think, or not?
I have published pro-life stories. I've published pro-choice stories, and I get criticized for both, definitely, but, you know, there's, in both cases, you're exploring the future, and I think story, it's, you know, I don't take a post, I think in fact authors are going to explore both sides of that issue, but why not? And actually, I haven't been severely criticized, a little bit, but the critics on one story were a little bit critical, but the readers all really liked it, and it was nominated for a Nebula Award, so I got no pushback from the readers. I didn't get any letters of concern, and it was a really thoughtful story with a character who was a flawed character, and I think the readers read it as they'd have to necessarily make, they would not make the same choices as this character, but they could be really involved and engaged with the character. We have new risks all the time. We have, you know, there's certainly far more exploration of transgender characters now in science fiction than there ever was when I came into the field, or when I came into the field, it was much more acceptable for that to be, for a person to be an object of ridicule in fiction. Now, the concept of transgender is much more explored sympathetically and interestingly. It doesn't mean the character can't be the villain in the story.
Nothing wrong with any of that. That's fine.
Again, there's, you know, a change, and I think for the better, but it's a change in our, everything changes. We push one way, and then we push the other way. That's what fiction is about.
Neil, do you have any, what are you saying at Clark's World? What kind of stories and themes, what are you looking at these days?
I'm not sure where you're asking me to go with that, but...
It's just, what are you saying, what kind of fiction are you getting?
Over the last 10 years, have stories changed? Well, we're seeing stories from a broader range of countries and things, so we're getting different perspectives on things, different cultural influences. I think it's providing us with a much more interesting base of stories to choose from, because I tend to look for things that are different than my past experiences. So, a few years ago, I ran a survey to get a handle on author influences, and I had demographics information with age ranges, gender, and then I mapped it to mine, and I found that the authors that I was more likely to publish had different influences than mine, because I'm looking for something that took a different track than my experience.
One thing I like that you're doing, well, I like a lot of it, but one specific thing is you do the translations. You do like one translation of foreign work every issue, don't you? And I mean, that's a great deal. That's a good, if you can find the translators, though.
We talk about the state of short fiction, and it's important for us to broaden our community beyond our borders. And I think works in translation help us see that there's stuff of interest outside our country. And at the same time, it lets them know, hey, you know, you're welcome in this pool, and send us more.
The trouble I always thought was that it was too costly and there weren't enough translators. How are you making that work? Well, that'll work. Good deal. We're almost finished here, but if there's any questions, you got a few minutes, anybody? Yes. Good question. Good question.
Oh, 20 years ago.
Yes.
It's wonderful. I'd like to bring and talk about that.
Somebody? Anybody?
I would definitely say yes, definitely. My reading changed a lot during 17 years when I was at the FSA. But it can be hard to pin down exactly what and where. I know, for instance, I lost interest in superhero stories somewhere along the line.
I've got a superhero story.
More power to you.
I know I understand that point, but this one's different.
They all say.
I like it, anyways.
Yes, sir?
You were talking about the variation.
Somebody asked me recently, was it you, John?
So was that?
Did you ask me recently about canon?
Look, I think canon's evolving and changing, and I think you're right. I mean, when I first started reading in this field actively, there was a very clear, what appeared to be a clear, coherent canon. it was what I've glibly referred to, lifting it from William Gibson, the Gernsback Continuum, right? And that was one story you could tell about the evolution of science fiction in the world we live in. A lot of validity, but it was one story. I think what we're becoming more aware of is, first of all, other canons. I think what we're also finding is a younger generation of readers and writers who are finding the idea of canon more of a burden than a benefit. I think if you look at it sort of chronologically, you know, when I entered the field, in the 70s, you know, modern science fiction was only so old, there's only so much older stuff to read. Now there's this enormous volume of stuff to read, and we seem to want to put some kind of admission thing on people. You know, like if you really want to talk about the field, you need to read this, you need to understand that. And to some degree, there's some truth to that. But I think we're also finding sort of, it needs to be broadly changed, opened up, and I think a time perhaps for a new canon to evolve. I mean, works from the 80s and 90s are only, I mean, like maybe the 90s are only just beginning to fall into a possible canon. You know, I mean, do you sit there and look at sort of, I don't know, Holy Fire by Bruce Sterling from 1995? Canon, not canon, you know.
Well, when I wrote back to you, I was saying that canon, it's become different readers have what amounts to their canon. And so, yes, I grew up at a time where probably my canon is, you know, Zelazny and Delaney and Phil K. Dick and Octavia Butler and Ursula Le Guin, say. Well, Ursula Le Guin, definitely. And then, and Jung Dinghy. But I think, I mean, authors now, and I know their canon is Octavia Butler and Lois McMaster from Joel, Connie Willis. And, you know, that's their, those are their canon. Because they grew up the 80s and the 90s, and that's who they were reading, and that was the deeply influential on them. So, as the field has opened up and had time to grow in age, because think about it, it was such a young form when that didn't have as much many stories to have read, that that writers are going to come from all different viewpoints. And I still have writers and people come up to me and saying that Isaac Asimov was this huge influence on them. You know, that's still the case, but it's also the case that they'll tell me that Lois McMaster Bujold was the biggest influence on them. So we're growing and we're aging, and so it's not set in stone. You know, there's no like, and I think that's the way it should be. It should not be set in stone. So.
Anybody else? Neil, anything else?
I think that canon, if you start looking at canon as a continuum, it's a problem. But if you look at canon as sort of a pyramid, where one generation influences another, and they just keep building and building and building. Mm-hmm. That's how I prefer to look at it, is that, yeah, they may not have read Asimov, but they read somebody who was influenced by Asimov, and that sort of keeps that spirit of the genre going.
And it's a conversation.
One last question.
Very true, we have different viewpoints. I mean, even when you think about, even back in the 50s, you have Frederick Brown's What Man Universe, where he completely sends up the idea of women, the skimpy clothing, you know, the ridiculousness of, you know, from his point of view at least, as an editor. He had been an editor, a science fiction editor,
So it wasn't even like it was a monolithic viewpoint in the past. It's never been a monolithic viewpoint. And it's true. As an editor, I'm reaching out to as many readers as possible. And I know, I mean, I always say my greatest success, my very first issue, I had one critic said, these two stories in this issue are the best, they're fantastic, they're wonderful, and these two stories are the worst, they just don't work for me at all. And then another critic said the same exact thing, like the two stories were completely different. I felt very successful.
On that note, we'll have to wrap it up. We're a little bit over time here. I want to thank the panelists very much. Thank you all. Oh, one more thing. Since Gordon Van Gelder was late, he's buying. Okay.
Hi, Jonathan. Hi.
How are you?
Good to see you.
How are you?
Would you mind getting just your picture?
No, no.
Do it, Matt, and I'm going to...
Sure.
I'm going to do as many as I can. We may not see each other again for a while.
Yeah, sure.
Everybody's
not. But now no longer
going to be. Yeah, you're going to have a
lot of this. Okay. One more. I'm not sure it went. I'm in focus. That'll work. I got it.
There you go.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it. You too.
Okay.
Fun panel, but I knew it was going to be this way. Well, you know, I didn't have time to tie stuff in like I wanted to. I didn't want to make it a social agenda thing, but I wanted to make that as the basis of the why readers are intimidated. I think it changed, but that wasn't my intention to make it a social agenda thing at all. That's the way it goes, though. I get my drink.
I know.
Oh, man.
It's about a hot lion.
That's the way it goes, though. I didn't expect any better. Where are we going? It's down first. Uh-huh. All right.
So it was late.
I know. I was freaking out.
Yeah, I figured. Many things to do in one day.
Yeah.
So what did you... Well, I'll ask you. What the opening moments are like.
With the pearls and stuff, shock, dismay, a couple of giggles, and then Neil Clark bit into me real quick. He was just pissed off right up there at the bat.
I came in to see that. But.
I think it's half my shit that I wanted to. I didn't want to make it all social agenda, as I told you. I was trying to tie all the damn shit in. Dang it. Oh well. It's over and done with now. Wait a minute. We want to go back this way. I'm sorry.